Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Chav Chet Amud Aleph by the two dots. The Gemara here is continuing to bring a series of memrot in which they begin Shalach Le Rabbi Abba, the Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama. Rabbi Abba sent over to Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama, and he gives them a halacha. The reason it's brought over here, we'll see in the second half of today's daf, we're bringing all sorts of memrot that have nothing to do with our Gemara at all, because one of these memrot has to do with our Gemara. Gemara aggregated all these statements of Rabbi Abba, the Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama, partly because the halacha is like him in almost all these instances, as we'll see in the end, but also brought it over here because of its connection to our Gemara. So, Shalach Le Rabbi Abba, the Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama, halacha govim min abadim. The halacha is that you have a right to collect from abadim. Now, obviously, if you're dealing with a debtor, you can collect from any of the possessions of the debtor. What we're speaking about here is whether abadim are mishubadim, encumbered to the loan. That will have impact on two scenarios. One scenario is with the Tomim, in a case where the debtor passed away, and now the children of the debtor are in possession of these items. You're only allowed to collect the outstanding debts of the debtor from the Tomim if it is collateralized by karka, if it has to do with land. You can't take metaltalim from the Tomim. In addition, from the kuchot as well. Buyers, you can go after the buyers if you have an encumbrance on that property, and you can go take it away from them after they have bought it. So what Rabbi Abba says to Rabbi Yosef is that the Avadim have the same din as Karka. That should not be a surprise to us because we have in many places, in terms of dinim, Avadim are considered to be like Karka. Eved Kanani has the same din as property, but not only property, but real property that's passed through Yerusha. The kinyanim on an eved are the same kinyanim that you make on karka. They're treated like real property in many areas. So all that Rabbi Abba is saying over here is, we're going to extend that din to the case of collections as well. As the Rishbam says, b'chov shemeit, goveh mim avdei yitomim, demikarkei dami. As the Rishbam points out, and we noted before, you treat them like karka, and therefore you can even collect from the yitomim. Rabbi Nachman amar, ein govin. Nachman says you do not collect from the Avadim. Now, first of all, this has impact because generally we paskin like Rav Nachman when it comes to Dinim because Rav Nachman was a Dayan, an expert Dayan, and given his experience as well as his erudition, we generally paskin like Rav Nachman. So Rav Nachman says this, that automatically means that the halacha is not like Rabbi Abba over here, but we're going to see later on in the sugya, the end of today's daf, that we do paskin like Rabbi Abba. So you're going to have to somehow reconcile between the two of them. And as the Rashbam points out over here, not that Rav Nachman disagrees fundamentally that Avadim are considered to be like real property, but this is an exception to that rule. In general, Avadim are classified as real property. In this one instance, they do not get that classification. And that has to do with the mentality of a lender. A lender will lend money based on the security that he has. But that security has to be something that he can rely on, something that he can count on being there. When it comes to karka, karka doesn't move. Karka doesn't go anywhere. So he sees that as being foolproof security, and he will lend based on the karka because he knows it can always come and get the asset. That's why people favor lending money when people are buying land, they're building a house. Certain objects that don't move, then you have the collateral and you have a way to extract the money that you are owed. On the other hand, when it comes to Avadim, even if you deem them as real property, nevertheless, the lender may not rely on them because they are, in essence, movable objects. They're animate, they can be sold, they can be moved around, they can be hidden, they can pass away, they can run away. There are all sorts of reasons why you wouldn't rely on them. And that's what the Rashbam notes over here. It has to do with samchei datayu. Do they rely on it? Do they count on that being the collateral that they're going to collect from? And the answer is no. So even though they are deemed to be like real property, in this instance, even they're being considered halakhically real property, in reality, people are not going to rely on them when it comes to the extension of loans, and therefore in Govin, you can't collect from them. Now here's another instance. Shalach Le Rabbi Abba, Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama. Halacha, the halacha is shlishi b'sheni kasher. A third generation testifying for a second generation is kasher. So in terms of generations, the way that Rishon, Sheni, and Shlishi work is based on the common denominator between the parties. It is the singular ancestor that is the beginning of the Shoshelet that leads to them. So the way that the Rashbam explains it, for instance, if you take two children of Yaakov, Yaakov is the common denominator between them. Reuben and Shimon, brothers, are considered to be a Rishon, Berishon, a first level with the first level, because Yaakov is the one that joins them. Then Reuben and Shimon, his sons, are Rishon, Berishon. They're the first generation from the common denominator between them. And the Rashbam continues that example by saying, in this instance, we're speaking about Nimuel, who is the son of Shimon. That makes him a Sheni. And then he says that Chanoch is the child of Reuven. Nimuel is the child of Shimon. So if you take Chanoch and Nimuel, they are first cousins, and they're classified as a Sheni B'Sheni. Then what Rabbi Abba is saying over here is, a Shlishi B'Sheni is Kasher. That means that Chanoch's son, Reuven's grandchild, is mutar to testify for Nimuel, Shimon's son. Or in essence, it's a first cousin once removed. So you are allowed to testify to a first cousin once removed. And the brothers, Reuven and Shimon, are considered to be Rishon Berishon. The first cousins, Nimuel and Chanoch, are considered to be Sheni B'Sheni. Then Chanoch's son is considered to be a Shlishi. So that Shlishi can testify for the Sheni, which is Shimon's son, Nimuel, or his first cousin once removed. That's the statement of Rabbi Abba. Rova Amar Af Berishon. Not only can a Shlishi testify for a Sheni, but he can even testify for a Rishon. That means that the son of Chanoch, who is the grandson of Reuven, can testify for Shimon. Or in essence, he could testify for his great uncle. They'd be permitted to testify in that instance, the grandson of Reuven, for Reuven's brother Shimon, which makes him his great uncle. Marba Ravashi, Achshar Ba'aba Da'aba. Marba Ravashi goes along and says that even you can testify for a grandparent. A grandchild can testify for a grandparent. So that's wild that Rabbi Ravashi would allow this. Tosafot points out, we know, im tomar afilu sheni b'sheni, amar b'zerek perek borer, the pasul. The Gemara explicitly says that first cousins are psulim. Certainly his grandfather should be excluded. If you're saying that first cousins can't testify for each other, why should a grandchild be able to testify for a grandparent? Because there's a generation skipped in between. So what the Tosafot says is, the way to create distance in terms of relatives is to put a generation gap between the parties. So just like by a Shlishi, the Rishon, with a great uncle, you have a generation gap. So too, by a grandchild and a grandparent, the father sits in between. And the generation gap allows you to testify because it brings distance that does not make them as, I guess, biased in these situations, or classified as a karov, even if they're not biased, to disqualify them in these situations. So Tosafot tries to justify Mar Bar Ravashi's position, but we started out with Rabbi Abba, who said that a first cousin once removed, a shlishi b'sheni, is kasher. We have Rova extend that and say not only is it a shlishi b'sheni, but even a shlishi b'rishon, the great uncle, he would be fine. And then we have, finally, Mar Bar Ravashi extending it even to say that a grandparent for a grandchild or vice versa would be fine. V'leit hilchotok Mar Bar Ravashi. Here, the Gemara makes an explicit statement that we don't accept that position of Mar Bar Ravashi. The reason being, as the Rashbam notes, is because Bnei Banim Harehem Kibanim. Grandchildren are considered to be like children, and it's as if there is no skip in the generation. Though, the Rashbam then takes it a step further and says, the Bnei Banim, Ubnei Bnei Banim, ad elef dorot, lo ye'idu lo avotehem, the ben yerech aviv hu. Because the child is always considered to be the extension of his father. That means that he thinks, whether it's a child for a father, a child for a grandfather, a child for a great-grandfather, a child for a great-great-great-grandfather, keep going up the stack, nobody can testify, because that stack, in essence, collapses. Because any father and child are considered to be a single entity. So anytime you're looking up the stack, you're just joining them all together into one big entity. So the Rashbam says, not only is he disqualified in terms of a grandchild to grandparent, but also anybody up that stack, directly up the line, father to son, all of them are disqualified because of this idea that a child is the extension of his father. And then in essence means that no matter how far back you go up, grandfather, great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, they're all one entity because of the fact that they're all just one extension of each father is an extension of the next. The Baal HaTosafot disagree and say, Lei Dilchot HaGemarashi Perish Bukundris, Tafilat Sof Kol HaDorot Pasul, Ve'ein Nir Alari, Kevan De'it Palek Dara Kalkach. Because there's such a great separation between the generations, that already makes it that they're not considered to be Krovim. He doesn't give you how far you have to go, but let's assume if the halacha is not like Mar Bar Vashi, he spoke about a grandparent. So clearly a grandparent, grandchild are disqualified. But a great-grandparent might not be disqualified according to the Balei Tosafot, because Itpalag Dara, you have another generation in between. So he's willing to accept Bnei Banim, Harei Kibanim. Grandchildren are classified like children, but he doesn't extend it beyond that. He doesn't say great-grandchildren are classified like children, and therefore based on that, he is willing to be matir up the stack as long as it's not a grandparent or a grandchild. So here you see a machloket between the Rishonim as to when we said Allah is not like Bar Bar Vashi, how far reaching are those implications? Is it simply saying that which he said here, grandparent to grandchild is disqualified? Or is it also saying, like the Rashbam suggests, that it disqualifies anybody along that line, grandparent, great-grandparent, great-great-grandparent, all the way up the stack, all of those are disqualified. Shalach le Rabbi Ava, Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama, so there's an additional halacha that's being sent by Rabbi Ava. He has testimony with regards to land, ad shelo nistama, before he lost his eyesight. Vinistama, and then he lost his eyesight. Pasul, he's disqualified from testifying over here. Rabbi Abba comes along and says that if he knew the edut of the karka beforehand, and then he became blind, so now he can't testify what he sees. He can't show you the demarcations of where the karka is, he's no longer valid as an aid. Shmuel Amar Kasher. Shmuel says he's fine as an aid. Efshad the Mekavi Matzvanaha. He could indicate where the borders are. That's what the Rashbam explains over here. He can simply give you delineations. He can say there's a tree at that corner. There's a river that runs this way. The neighboring properties are such and such. He can still testify without ever pointing out and directly showing you where the borders are, there are markers, there are guideposts along the way where he could give you a description that would sufficiently explain where the borders are. So Shmuel says he should be able to testify in that case. When it comes to a cloak or comes to a piece of clothing, there if he went blind, he can't testify to it because there are too many pieces of clothing with the same type of coloring, the same type of shape or look. And therefore, how could he define for you without seeing it, without having it to be at the ayin? How could he define for you or tell you that this is the cloak that belongs to so-and-so? Rav Sheshet Amar, Afilu Glima. Sheshet says, even by a cloak, Efshar Demikavin Midat Arko Midak Rachbo. Maybe he knows the exact measurements of the height, the width, the waistline, whatever it is that is unique about this cloak. Maybe he has that information and he can provide that information. Or if there's a specific siman that is in the cloak that he could provide, why shouldn't he be able to testify in that case? Aval naschalo. When it comes to metals, when it comes to objects that don't have measurements by size, there he can't testify. Rav Papa Amar, afilu naschon. Papa says even by metals he could testify. Esher nemekavi midat mishkalotav. He might know the weight of the item, the exact weight of this metal composite, or whatever this jewel or special item is that he has there, he might know the exact weight of it. So even though he can't describe it by its measurements, he could describe it by its weight. And that should be a sufficient reason to listen to his testimony and have him give us guidance about who this belongs to. Meitave. So now we bring a question from a braita. If he knew testimony for him before he became his son-in-law, and then he became his son-in-law, Pikeach, he was somebody who was of sound mind, v'nitcharesh, and then he became a cheresh. The way that I explained it over here now is according to the Rashbam. The Rashbam over here says there are two ways to possibly explain what this statement means. It could be pikeach, everything was fine, v'nitcharesh, and then he lost his ability to hear and to speak. Or you could read it, pikeach, that he was totally fine, and then nitcharesh, he lost his ability to speak. But associated with that lack of ability to speak is the fact that he is no longer of sound mind. And that is true in the Gemara in general. The Gemara in general equates between a cheresh and a shoteh. That the cheresh is classified like a shoteh. In their day, it was almost inevitable because they didn't have a way or mechanism for getting around the problem of cheresh. The inability to hear, the inability to speak rendered a person a shoteh because there was no way for them to communicate. They didn't have a sign language. They didn't have a way for them to learn so that they could become more intelligent. And therefore, the cheresh and the shoteh were classified in the same category. We've spoken about this numerous times, that the poskim in the modern day separate between the two because of that change in the nature of way we communicate and the ability for a cheresh to be intelligent. But the Rashbam over here, for halachic reasons, in the Braita, says it must be that that's what the Braita is saying, because the Braita here is speaking about disqualifications that come because they're a psul edut. There's something wrong with them that disqualify them from testifying. Not a technical psul, but actually an inherent psul in the individual. If the problem here simply was that the cheresh couldn't speak, that's a technical problem. He has testimony. He could testify, but he can't testify because he can't speak. He can't articulate the testimony that he has. And we have a rule, mipihem velo mipiktavam, that you can only take testimony verbally or orally. You cannot take testimony in writing. So even though he can communicate in writing, we can't take the testimony in writing. There is a Rabbeinu Tam that suggests that this rule is much more narrow than we thought, and that is that the disqualification of mihabam mivilbichtavam is only in a case where they can't verbally or orally articulate the testimony. If they can testify, then they can write in their testimony. Since they have the capacity to give over testimony, they can write in their testimony. It's a big chiddush of the Rabbeinu Tam. Then mipihem lo bichtavam only applies when there's an inability to testify, then writing is pasul. But if you can't testify, writing is fine. Most Rishonim believe that you just can't write in testimony. It's completely invalid. In this case, even the Rabbeinu Tam would have to admit there's a problem because he can't testify. He can't articulate the testimony, and therefore his writing in would be a problem. So what the Rashbam points out is that's a technical problem. The technical problem, he's not a pasul de'edut, he just can't testify. But the Braita here is speaking about situations not in which there's a technical problem, but there's an inherent psul. Inherent psul would be someone who's a shoteh, is not of sound mind. That person can't testify, not because of a technicality, but because their testimony is completely invalid because of their state of being. So that's why he favors saying that pikeach nitcharesh is equivalent or equated to the case of shoteh. Piteach v'nistama. He had eyesight, perfect eyesight, v'nistama, and then he went blind. Shafoi, he was of sound mind, v'nishtata, and then he lost his mind. Pasul, all of these edim are psulim, because they are inherently pasul. One of them because he's a relative, that's chatano, his son-in-law. The other is because they've lost their minds, or have not sound mind, and they can't testify. We see here that the piteach v'nistama, the person who was once able to see and now blind is disqualified from testifying over here. Aval, ayeh yodea lo edut. He knew the testimony ad shelo naseh chatano. Before he became his son-in-law, he had witnessed the event. He knew the testimony. Benaseh chatano. Then he became his son-in-law. Umeita bito. And then this individual's wife passed away, meaning the daughter of this individual passed away, and therefore he's no longer a son-in-law anymore. They've severed the relationship. Pikeach. He was, again, here we're going to translate it as sound mind, but it means that he was capable of communicating. Vinitcharesh. And then he lost his ability to hear and speak. Vichazar vinitpakeach. And then once again, he regained his capacity to speak and to hear. Piteach. He was of clear eyesight. Vinistama. And then he lost his eyesight. Vichazar vinitpatach. And then he regained his eyesight. Shafui. He was of sound mind. Vinishtata. Lost his mind. Vichazar vinishtafa. And then he came back to being of sound mind. Kasher, all of these testimonies are fine. Zaklal, this is the principle. Kol shetchilato osofo bepaslut pasul. If at the moment of witnessing the event, they were disqualified, or at the moment of testimony they are disqualified, then they are disqualified. On the other hand, tchilato osofo bekashrut kasher. If at the moment that they witness the event, as well as the time that they are testifying, they are ksherim, then their edut is kasher no matter what transpired in the interim. Or in essence, what we say is there's no concept of dichoy by edut. We have this concept in kodoshim and other areas where if you lose your status, it disqualifies you completely. So something that could have been made into ektesh and then loses that capacity and then comes back again, that's what we call dichoy. It was pushed out of the ability to be kadosh or to be used in a certain circumstance, depending on the circumstance, we say that that dichui renders it permanently disqualified. Over here, we don't have that by the edut. If there's a temporary disqualification, if that disqualification is removed, then it's fine for you to testify. As long as when you witness it, you didn't have the problem, and when you testify, you don't have the problem, that's fine. Mihu, Mia, despite all this, to yufta, the kuhu, to yufta. This is a strong refutation of the positions of Shmuel, Rav Sheshet, and Rav Papa. It undermines them, because they all said that a blind person can testify in at least certain circumstances. Shmuel said by Karka, Rav Sheshet said even by Glima, and Rav Papa said even by Nascha. But the common denominator between all of them is that he can testify at least by Karka. The Braita that we just brought says he's completely disqualified. If he went blind, he's disqualified. The only way he could testify is if he gained his eyesight back again. But absent that, there is no testimony which is permitted by him. So therefore, this is a Tanaic work that undermines that position of those three Amoraim. And obviously, that would make us heavily favor Rabbi Abba's position, who said exactly that. That if a person had seen or witnessed something and then went blind afterwards, he can't testify. He's no longer qualified to be a witness. Salach Rabbi Abba, Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama, another memra of Halacha sent by Rabbi Abba, Homer Altinok Ben Abanim Ne'aman. So here we go. Finally, we reach what's relevant to our sugya. And that's why this whole series of memrot is brought over here, because of this memra, which is, he sends him that a tinok, a child amongst the boys, Ne'aman. The father is Ne'aman. Yochanan Amar, Enu Ne'aman. Yochanan disagrees and says he's not believed. Maika Amar. What exactly is the scenario here? Amar Abayi, Hachik Amar. This is what is meant by Rabbi Abba's statement. Homer al tinok ben abanim, yirash kol nechasai, Ne'aman. He says about one of the children amongst the other children that he should inherit all of my possessions. He is believed. Ki Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, similar to Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, we're going to bump into in the upcoming Mishnah. We've already bumped into him a number of times. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says that as long as you distribute your Yerusha to people who are rightful heirs to Yerusha, you can reallocate it any way you want. So if you have multiple children, all of them are entitled to inherit you, you can decide the allocation of your Yerusha, and that does not undermine the Din HaTorah. So you can give 100% to one child and disinherit all the other children, because that one child was a rightful heir. He should have only gotten a percentage of the Yerusha. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, we'll see from the Psukim, says that the father has a certain amount of control on that allocation. So that's what Rabbi says is being said by Rabbi Abba, that the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, that you're allowed to redistribute the assets or reallocate the assets, and here he gave all of his possessions to one child. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Inu Ne'aman Ki Rabbanan. Yochanan says, no, the halacha is like the Rabbanan against Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, and you don't have a right to redistribute or reallocate the Yerusha. It'll be divided evenly between the brothers. Matki Flo Rova, Rova says, Rabbi, I don't understand your explanation. Hi, Ne'aman, Ve'enu Ne'aman. The halacha that is being argued between Rabbi and Rabbi Abba and Rabbi Yochanan is he believed or is he not believed? What does that have to do with our case over here? The question in our case is, Yirash, Velo Yirash Mi Ba'ilei. Does he inherit or does he not inherit? That's the question at hand. If you think the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, the father's successful at reallocating all the property to a single son, and that son inherits everything. Or another way around, if we believe like Rabbi Yochanan that the halacha is like the Rabbanan, you can't reallocate, and then he doesn't inherit all the property. But the only question is he successful and the child does inherit it? Or is he unsuccessful and he doesn't inherit? It has nothing to do with Ne'manut. It has nothing to do with the believability of the father. So your explanation of this doesn't make so much sense. Elomar Rova, Hochi Kamar. This is the way to explain the machloket between Rabbi Abba and Rabbi Yochanan. Homer al tinok ben abanim bechorhu neman ka Rabbi Yehuda. If a person says about a child amongst the other children that he is classified as a bechor, neman, he is believed ke Rabbi Yehuda. Like Rabbi Yehuda, who we saw in yesterday's daf, the machloket between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim, can a father finger the Bechor and say that child is the Bechor. Now, obviously, if there's no counter evidence, of course he's believed to say that that child is the Bechor. Even the Rabbanan agreed to that. The question is when there's a Chazakah going against him. There's either a Chazakah, we saw yesterday possibly the Ramban, who says even Edim going against him. Does the father have the ability to overcome that and still say that this is the Bechor? Rabbi Yehuda believed yes. The Chachamim said no. So now what they're saying here is the machlokah here between Rabbi Abba and Rabbi Yochanan is as to whom we paskin like. Do we paskin like Rabbi Yehuda? That's what Rabbi Abba is saying. That he's Neman. The fathers believe to finger the Bechor, despite the fact that we believe there's another child that is a Bechor. The other hand, Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Inu Neman ki Rabbanan. The other hand, Rabbi Yochanan believes he's not believed like the Rabbanan. So now Rabbi Abba and Rabbi Yochanan are lining up as to whom we paskin like. Do we paskin like Rabbi Yehuda, or do we paskin like the Chachamim? As a derivative of this, because we're going to see at the end of today's daf, that the halacha is like Rabbi Abba. If the halacha is like Rabbi Abba, that means the halacha is also like Rabbi Yehuda. How far does that go? We saw yesterday in the Balei HaTosafot that the Bahag says that Rabbi Yehuda, when we pass like Rabbi Yehuda, it's only for the father to identify the Bechor. And if it happens to be when he identifies the Bechor, he also disqualifies other children and makes them into Mamzerim, that's fine. But what he can't do is directly be Posel a child. Because if you remember, Rabbi Yehuda made two statements. One statement was he can identify the Bechor. The second statement is he can identify the Ben Chalutza and Ben Grusha. What Bahag says is when Rabbi Abba comes and paskins like Rabbi Yehuda, it's only one of those two events. How does he know that? Because of the circumstance. It says here, Homera Tinok Ben Abanim Bechorhu. If he says about a child amongst other children that he is classified as the Bechor, then that is a valid statement. Now that valid statement also has implications from it, which is the fact that he will disqualify other children. And in that way, the Bahag says the Locha is like Rabbi Yehuda only in that instance. In an instance where you identify the Bechor, you disqualify or you posel other children. But if you want to directly go posel children, the Locha is not like Rabbi Yehuda. We saw yesterday that the Ri disagreed. The Ri says that's not the case. We find other places in Shas that we paskin like Rabbi Yehuda. And we say the Locha is like Rabbi Yehuda over here, it means across the board. Not only to identify the Bechor and possibly disqualify other children, but even to directly disqualify or posel a child, a father is believed in that case. And therefore, the Ri and many of the Rishonim disagree with the Bahag and say, Allah is like Rabbi Yehuda across the board. There is one interesting day on the Tosafot Arid over here with regards to the statement of Tinok Ben Abanim. You're talking about a child amongst the other children. He says that's the only case where the father is believed to possibly disqualify other children, or to say that he is a Bechor. It's a Tinok. It's a child that looks younger than other children. So you would have thought, just from eyeing the children, that the oldest child is the one that is the tallest, looks the oldest, has gray hair, whatever it is, he who assumed that they were the Bechor based on physical features. The father has a right to come along and say, Tinok Ben Abanim, the one who looks younger is really the Bechor. That's the only case where the father has Nemanut, is not against a chazaka necessarily, not necessarily against the deem, not to posel children. The only case where he has the ability to change the dynamic is if our conclusion came from the physical features of the children. He can undermine that and say, you're looking at it wrong, this child happens to be older, even though he looks younger. And so the read severely limits the psak like Rabbi Yehuda. Again, the Bahag already is more expansive. It says you can be posel other children if you identify the Bechor, even against the Chazoka, again, the Ramban, even against the Edim. And then we have the more expansive view of the Ri in the Balei Tosafot yesterday, and many other Rishonim who believe that you have full rights to be Naaman when the father says the child is Pasul. We paskin like Rabbi Yehuda, but that's the question is how far do we paskin like Rabbi Yehuda? So these Rishonim are arguing when we say here the Halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda, how far does that go? A next case. Shalach lei Rabbi Abba, Rabbi Yosef bar Chama. Homer, titol ishti, kechad min abanim. My wife should take a portion like one of the children. Notelet, kechad min abanim. That works, and she can take a portion amongst the children. So let's break down the case. First of all, what is he offering her here? There are two possibilities. He's either offering her a replacement for a ketubah, and saying, instead of your ketubah, you'll take a portion in the estate like one of the children. In that case, you would need the acquiescence of the woman. He can't unilaterally invalidate her ketubah and say, I'm offering you an alternative. She would have to agree in that case. So in that instance, you would need the woman's acquiescence. On the other hand, the other possibility is that he's giving her this in addition to her ketubah. So it's nothing to do with the ketubah being replaced, but simply this is an additional part of the estate. She's entitled to her ketubah. In addition to that, I'm granting you another portion in the estate that you will inherit amongst the children. The other problem now is, well, if he does that, how is he qualified or entitled to do such a thing if that undermines Yerusha and Midoraita? Midoraita, the children are the primary heirs to the father, not the wife. How is he giving her a portion amongst the children? So there are, again, two possibilities. Either he is a Shechiv Meira, he's on his deathbed, and therefore when he dictates things, we consider them as if they are written, and as if there's a Kinyan done. Or you could be speaking about a bari, a healthy individual, where he made a kinyan, which is that the lashon of titol is a lashon matana. He is not saying that she will inherit as Yerusha her portion. He's basically granting her a gift and saying, this portion of the estate you are entitled to from today. This is a gift to you. It will only be effective when I pass away, but the gift or the portion is granted to you today. So then Rabbi Abba comes along and says about this din, that you are able to do this, then you are entitled to take that portion amongst the children, and she does get a portion of the estate. This is successful. Rava comes along and qualifies this din of Rabbi Abba and says, it's only true for assets that are in the estate today. The division or the divisor is based on the point of death. So let's separate out the issues. The first of which is, if it is a gift, because he can't give her Yerusha, Yerusha, the Torah says, doesn't go to the wife. So it must be that he's gifting her assets. The only thing he can gift her are assets that exist today. He can't gift her future assets, because that's davar shelo ba'di olam. And you can create a kinyan. And the Rashbam points out over here, even according to Rabbi Meir, afilu Rabbi Meir damar adam makneh, that a person can be makneh davar shelo ba'di olam, hani mile b'mifaresh. That's only if he articulates that he's giving things in the future that will come into the possession. Ava bistama, if he makes no mention of future assets, en adam ale al dato davar aroi lo lavo laknoto ala davar shu mukzakbo. Person doesn't have in mind then, without articulating specifically that he's thinking about future assets, he doesn't think about future assets, he's thinking about the assets that are in his possession today. So therefore the Rashbam says, even according to Rabbi Meir, who says you can be makneh davar shelo ba'di olam, over here that doesn't matter. So since the mechanism for granting her this right is a gift, it will only work from that point retroactively, it will now work that point forward. So you can't mikana laba, any assets that come into the estate she has no entitlement to. That's number one. The second thing is that when they go to divide up the assets of the estate, how do you determine how many children there are in that situation? At the point that he gave her the gift, there might have only been 3 children. By the time he passes away, there could be 5, 6 children that are splitting up the estate. Which is the divisor we use for giving her portion of the property? So what Rava says is that we use as the divisor the children at the point of death. That is because the way that he expressed it is, she will take a portion like the children. Well, the children take their portions at the moment of Yerusha. So therefore, the division of the property will be dependent on the number of children at the time of the death of the husband. But the portion that she gets will only use the allocation of property that existed at the time of the matana. And the Rashbam says that this works both the Chumrah and the Kula. The way the Rashbam says it, that Rava's din, that you divide it by the number of children at the point of death, means both if there are more children at the time of death, she will get less of a portion, or if there are less children at the point of the death of the husband, then she will get a larger portion because there are less children to divide up the estate. I mean, it's a two-way street, because he's just saying that the chalukah will be done like the Yerusha, and whoever's present at the time of the Yerusha will determine how we divide it up. There are other Rishonim that disagree with the Rashbam and say that it's only in a case where there are more children afterwards do we say that we go after the point of Yerusha. But if there are less children, then the husband didn't have in mind to give her a larger portion. He was basically capping out her portion. He's saying, look, you get a portion amongst the children. The property that's available is anything till this point in time in the estate. And the maximum size of that portion is based on the number of children today. If there are more children born, then your size will go down. Your allocation will go down. If there are less children, you're not going to get more than this. This is the maximum amount. And so other Rishonim view it in that way, that it's only if there are more children do we say we reallocate it based on that. If there are less children, then you allocate it based on the time of the gift. Now, why does this work? Or why do we go after the children at the time of death? Isn't that almost undermining the whole idea here? The idea is that he's gifting it to her now, and therefore it's not subject to Yerusha. But by doing this, you're actually tying it to the Yerusha because you're saying it's the children at the time of Yerusha. So what you have to answer is that the division at the time of Yerusha, the number of children at the time of Yerusha, is not determining the Yerusha. It's simply determining how the Yerusha is divided or the allocation of the Yerusha. So it's not something that's dependent on the death of the husband. It's something that just gives definition to the property that she was gifted. She was given a gift. She was given the property. Now we want to know exactly how to allocate or redivide the property. That can be determined later. That can be determined at the time of death. That does not make it into Yerusha. It remains a gift today. Just the size of the gift will be determined later on. But that doesn't change the fact that there was a gift, there was a kinyan, and there was a transference in sense of ownership today that will be effective at the time of the death of the husband. So now, isn't this considered to be something of a davar shelo ba'al olam, where the individuals who are going to be the factors in the division of the property are not yet born? So how can they be included in the gifting over here? This should be closely related, which we'll see later on in the Masechta, to a davar shelo ba'al olam. So the answer is that they are not the determinants of the gift. They aren't the parties that are granting the gift. They are simply factors in the division of the gift to his wife. And therefore, they don't disqualify the gift because they're not yet born, because they aren't the ones who are granting the gift. They aren't the ones that are going to pass on the gift to the woman. They're simply a factor in how much of an allocation she will get in that case. And his allocation of the property to those parties that have yet to be born is not invalid because of the fact that they're yorshim. They're going to get that piece of property as yorshim, not as a matana. So their diminishment of her gift is not giving property to someone who doesn't exist yet, because they aren't getting it as a gift. They're going to get it through being yorshim. And therefore, he's diminishing her gift by declaring that whoever is a yoresh will determine the size of her property. So for both of those reasons, both that the Banim only determine the size of the gift, not the gift itself, as well as the fact that the Banim themselves, in taking their allocation, get it as Yerusha, not a Matana, that's not considered to be Tola B'mishenu Yacholik Not, that you're conditioning the Kinyan or the gift on someone who has no ability to be Koneh now, because he's only going to exist in the future, because their existence in the future has nothing to do with the Kinyan. It's either Yerusha, or it's just a mechanism for determining the size of her Yerusha. Their kinyan is not what determines her gift itself. Shalach lei Rabbi Ava to Rabbi Yosef bar Chama. So again, another case where Rabbi Ava paskens halacha. Amotzi shtar chov al chaveiro. Someone who whips out a shtar and says, you owe me money. Malve omer lo nifrati klum. The Malve says, I was not paid anything. It's an interesting way to phrase it. Generally, you usually say, the Malveh says, lo parata klum. You did not pay anything. Over here, it uses the verb in the passive form. I was not repaid anything. That's what the Malveh says. The Loveh omer parati mechza. The Loveh says, I pay back half of the loan. This would seemingly be your classic case of modeh b'miktzat. The Loveh is saying, I paid back half of the outstanding debt. The creditor is saying, you paid none of the outstanding debt. But there's a little twist here. Veidim, Eidim, Shaparakulo. Eidim show up and say he repaid the entire amount. So now we have a problem, because the Eidim's testimony undermines both parties here. It undermines the Malveh, because it says that the shtar is no longer valid because it was completely repaid. On the other hand, the Loveh says he owes half the money. And these Eidim are saying that he doesn't owe anything. So now, what do you do in this circumstance here in order to settle everything that's outstanding? So he says, Hare ze nishba v'gova mechsa minechasim b'nei chorim aval memishubadim lo d'amre anan ha'edim samchinan. So the solution to the problem is, he takes a shvua, who the he is, we'll discuss in 1 second. Then, gova mechsa minechasim b'nei chorim. He has to pay half, 50% of what is owed. That's what he admitted to. The way that the Rashbam formulates it is, hudat baldin k'mei edim dali. Doesn't matter what the edim say, you admitted that you owe money. So now, the way that the Rashbam structures the case, and the Rishonim agree, is that the Eidim obviously came to testify after the debtor. After the debtor already said, I owe half, the Eidim come along and say he doesn't owe anything. Because obviously, if they came before, he would just agree with the Eidim. He wouldn't say that I owe half. The fact that he says I owe half, and then the Eidim show up, is what creates the situation or the problem here. So the solution, according to Rabbi Abba, is he has to pay that half. Because Hodat Baldin Kamei Eidim Dami. Once he admitted to owing the money, doesn't matter what any Eidim say. He admitted to an obligation, he's got to pay that obligation. On the other hand, with regards to the rights of collection of the creditor showed up with a shtar over here. Since he has a shtar, he's entitled to collect from the Chasim Mishubadim. So there, we say, wait a minute. As far as the shtar is concerned, it's been disqualified by the Eidim. The Eidim say the shtar is fully repaid. So the shtar is no longer valid. Why is the debtor paying over here? Because of his own admission. With regards to his own admission, he could obligate himself to pay money. He can't obligate other parties to pay money based on his admission. The other parties, which are the buyers of the debtor's property, will say, we believe the edim. The edim say, it was all repaid. You have no right to come with that shtar and collect from us. So what you can do is you can take that repayment from his free and clear property. And that's what Rabbi Abaco says. The admission obligates him. That admission only obligates him to repay 50% of the outstanding debt from free and clear property. That's the way that Rabbi Abba formulates the halacha. Now, as far as who takes the shvua over here, so the Rabbeinu Gershom says, Hilka Chamin and Hocha Nishba Hamalve. The creditor takes a shvua, the govemi mechsa shukuferlo, and he collects from the half 50% that he denied, hovo tzielav shtar. Because he has a shtar backing him up, along with the shvua, he has enough power to collect that 50%, that kofer that he denied. Because in order to be mekayim the shtar, the chachamim requires kiyum shtarot. That's a din d'rabbanan. Even though d'oraita the shtar is valid, mi d'rabbanan, we want you to be mekayim the shtar. So we use the shvua of the malveh to do that. So on the other hand, the Rashbam says, the person taking the shvua over here is the loveh. The shvua that he's taking is the shvat moder b'miksat. And he has to take that shvua because of the fact that he was moder b'miksat. And then he pays back that half. The only the protection that comes from the edim is the fact that the creditor can only collect from free and clear property, not from encumbered property. But otherwise, this looks like a classic case, a moda b'miksat. Now, why does he have to be nishba? Look at the Tosafot, the top Tosafot says, near the reed, t'hochi neman b'shvua, mishum t'chashiv k'milve al peh. It's considered to be an oral loan. Shar edim, edim, shar parua. Because the edim disqualified the shtar. But even though, according to his own words, the edim are psulim, shari machisham, he disagrees with them. And the debtor says, I'm really chayev half. The only validation of the contract now, or the outstanding credit, is from the debtor. As far as the edim are concerned, the shtar is invalid. For the only reason that we can say the shtar valid at all is because of the admission of the debtor. And therefore, I'd like my paramexa. Velo domi the moda vishtar shekatavo sheinu tzarech lekayemo. It's not like your classic case where if a debtor agrees that he wrote or he penned the document, that's enough of a kiyum shtar, because over there you don't have any contradicting evidence to say that the shtar is invalid. In our case over here, you have edim gmurim saying that the shtar is invalid. Since you have signatories to the shtar is completely valid midoraita. Midorabani, you need a kiyum shtar. That can be overcome by the debtor agreeing that he wrote the shtar. Over here, the debtor's admission can't overcome the problem because you don't have a kosher shtar over here. You have edim testifying that it's a pasul shtar. So the only way to validate the obligation over here is because it's a milval pen now. It becomes an oral loan. It's an oral loan. You can't collect from mishubadim. And you require a shvua in order to poter himself. He has to poter himself because now it turned into an oral loan where he's a modeh b'miksat. And that modeh b'miksat, he's got to deal with the shvua of being a modeh b'miksat. Or for the Rabbeinu Gershom, the malveh needs to take a shvua that there really is this outstanding oral loan that is detached from the contract, detached from the credit document. Tosfot asks over here, why isn't he poter from a shvua? Because this is classified to be helach. Because he's saying, here, take your money, here's your stuff, take it, and that's not a classification of modeh b'miksat, but rather halach, where you are patur from a shvua. So Bayit Tosfot would say, that's only true when the shtar is powerful enough to collect mimishabdei. But if it's not powerful enough to collect mimishabdei, then in essence it becomes like a milve al peh, and it is considered to be then a case of modeh b'miksat and not a case of halach that we discussed in the beginning of the Gemara in Bava Metzia. So now, Vafilu the Rabbi Akiva. Even according to Rabbi Akiva, the Amar Meshiva Veda Havi, in a situation where a person admits to owing money, where they didn't have to admit to that amount, Rabbi Akiva considers them or classifies them as a Meshiva Veda. There is a rule when you return a Veda, you're not subject to a Shvua. You're doing something good. You're doing a nice thing for a person. If we start subjecting people who are returning a Vedot to a shvua, then they're not going to do hashavat aveda. Or in essence, being a good Samaritan, you're getting penalized having to take a shvua. So the Chachamim said there is no shvua for a meshiv aveda, even if it looks like a modeh b'miksat. He brings in an item, the guy says, the full item was, I lost this. And the guy says, all I found, here it is. So now he's technically a modeh b'miksat. Nevertheless, he's a meshiv aveda, he's patur mishvua. Other situations are in a case we have a contract that says he owes him shekel. He owes him dollars in the plural. Well, the minimum amount is two. This guy goes in and admits he owes him five, he owes him ten, whatever the number is. Rabbi Akiva classifies the excess amount above the base amount to be meshiv aveda. He could have just admitted to two, and the contract would have backed him up, and he wouldn't have been obligated to pay any more. If he adds in more money and says that it's more than the minimum of two because it's written in plural, that's a meshiv aveda. You don't have to take a shvua. So what he's saying here is, even according to Rabbi Akiva, who normally classifies him as a meshiv aveda, hani mile hecha deleka edim. That's only when there are no witnesses. In a case where they're edim, the love is scared. Since he is scared, that's what caused him to be modeh b'miktzat over here. So what we're saying is that in a normal circumstance where a person is voluntarily obligating themselves or admitting to the fact that they owe money or they're meshiv aveda, there Rabbi Akiva says, you don't have to take a shvua. In this instance, the loveh was scared. And as the Bali Tosafot and the Rashbam point out, he knew there were edim coming to testify. According to the Rashbam, he didn't know at all what they were going to testify about. According to the Bali Tosafot, he might have even known that these edim were coming to testify on his behalf. He thought the edim were going to say something in his favor. But nevertheless, in the end, he doesn't really know what they're going to say. Even though they told him they're going to testify on his behalf, they might come in the end and say something different. Therefore, he's too scared to be kofer bakol. Because of the fact that if he was kofer bakol and the edim undermine him, he's going to be caught a liar. He's going to be chuksa kafran. And then he will be discredited as a witness. So he's modem miksat to protect himself. And that reason he's not considered to be a meshiv aveda. In this instance, you could have classified him as a meshiv aveda. The edim say the contract is invalid or the credit document is invalid. The creditor is saying you owe me money. The edim are saying it's done. There's no credit document over here. The malva has nothing to collect with. So when he admits to half of it, he's like a meshiv aveda. He's giving him something that he wouldn't have gotten. It's odat maldinka me'edim dummy. He's giving him free money that he wasn't entitled to. So he should have classified him as a meshiv aveda and not have to take a shvua. What we're pointing out over here is, even according to Rabbi Akiva, who normally says meshiv aveda doesn't take a shvua, here it's different. Because the reason he admitted to half is not because he's just being a nice guy or he's telling the truth. It's because he has the pressure of the edim behind him and he knows these edim are coming to testify. Again, whether he knows or doesn't know what they're going to testify about, it's a machloket there between the Tosafot and the Rashbam, but he knows they're hanging in the background. And so he knows these edim could come and undermine him, so it's too risky to be kofer bakol, and therefore his modem miksat is deemed to be a real type of hoda'ah, and not a meshiv aveda, and he will have to take a shvua, even according to Rabbi Akiva. And as the Tosafot says over here, had it not been, or the fear of the edim backing out of their testimony on his behalf, he would have had amigo over here. Amigo that he could have been kofer bakol. He could have denied the whole thing because he had edim backing him up. So therefore, he would have had a good amigo and he would have been patur legamre. He would have been backed up by that statement. And therefore, when he admits to half, he should be believed. He could have been kofer bakol. Instead, he admitted to half, he should be believed because he's admitting to more than he should have admitted to. But because of the fear of the edim, and he doesn't know exactly what they're going to testify, had they testified first, he would have been covered. And if it was then he admitted to half of it, he'd be a meshiv aveda. But because they're testifying after him, and he fears about their testimony, that ruins the migo for him, and therefore he doesn't have believability by saying, I'm chayav half over here. Mat givla amar baravashi, adarabo, should be just the opposite. Afilu Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, according to Rabbi Shimon Elazar, who disagrees with Rabbi Akiva over there and says he's not classified as a meshiv aveda, and he has to take a shvua of a modem miksat. Damar modem miksat at Tana Habi. He's classified as a modem miksat. Obviously not in a classic case of hashavat aveda, but in a case where, for instance, you have a contract that says he owes a plural amount of shekel, dollars, pounds, whatever it is, it's in plural, the minimum is two. But he admits to six, then he admitted to more than he should have. Is he classified then as a modem miksat if the creditor has a larger claim against him? Or is he a meshiv aveda because he's doing more than the contract would obligate him? Rabbi Akiva says he's a meshiv aveda because he's giving back more than the contract would have obligated him. The creditor is asking for 10. He's saying he's giving 6. He owes 6. The contract says he owes 2. So the additional 4, Rabbi Akiva says is meshiv aveda. The other, Rabbi Shimon Elazar, says no. He's classified as a modem miksat. Doesn't matter. The contract backs up the plurality of the item. But that's a minimum of 2. But now that he admitted to 6, he's saying the contract was 6. The other guy's asking for 10. So that's a modem miksat and he has to take a shvua. So that's what Mara Ravashi says. Even according to Rabbi Shimon Elazar, that says normally modem miksat atayna avi, and he would have to take a shvua. Hani mila echa deleke edim. That's when there are no edim that come asayale, that back him up. In that case, you just have the shtar, and you have the creditor and the debtor speaking. He's a modem mitzvah. Aval ha'icha de'ike edim. Over here, where you have edim, the gamisayile, that back him up in this instance, vaday meshiva vedav. Clearly, he's a meshiva veda. Not the fear of the edim, but knowing that edim are going to come and disqualify the shtar means that he should be classified as a meshiva veda. So that, again, assumes that he has some inkling about what the edim are going to testify about. He thinks they're going to testify on his behalf. Given that, he's relying on that to be kofer bakol. The fact that he wasn't kofer bakol shows you that he's just being a meshiva veda. He's returning the item as if it was a meshiva veda and should not be chayav in a shvua. So Mar Rav Ashi disagrees with Rabbi Abba and says that not only does he not have to take a shvua over here, but even according to one who normally says you have to take a shvua when you're classified like this meshiva veda case of modem mitzvah, over here he would agree that you don't have to pay because the edim are backing him up. On the other hand, Rabbi Abba says that he has to pay the money back. And even according to Rabbi Kiva, who normally says you don't have to take a shvua, here you'd agree you have to take a shvua because the edim are coming after the testimony. And that's the question here. The edim coming after the testimony, how do they affect the testimony? According to Rabbi Abba, it brings a fear in the debtor, and therefore he admits. And that means that his migo's gone. That means that we don't believe him, and his admission is considered to be a full admission and not a meshiv avida. According to Mar Rav Ashi, the fact that edim are coming and he has an inkling they're going to be in his behalf or in his favor, that's enough to give him cover to say whatever he wants to say. And in that case, when he says it, he's a meshiv aveda, because he could have been kofer bakol and walked away from the whole case knowing that their edim are going to back him up. Fact now that he is modem mitzvah, there's a meshiv aveda, and he shouldn't have to take a shvua at all. Now we say, Dorosh Marzutra Mishmed Rav Shimi Bar Ashi, in all of these instances, when Rabbi Abba sent over a halacha or a memra to Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama, the halacha is like Rabbi Abba. So that's why this has huge impact, because we just went through a series of halachot that are from all over Shas, and each of these cases we're saying the halacha is like Rabbi Abba. Relevant to our sugya is that Rabbi Abba paskin like Rabbi Yehuda. And now we're saying the halacha is like Rabbi Abba, that the halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda. So I'm the Ravina the Ravashi, the Rav Nachman Mai. What are you going to do with the Rav Nachman? That's a stira in your Klalei HaPsach. Normally you'd paskin like Rav Nachman. And Rav Nachman disagreed with Rabbi Abba in what we started with today. In the case of Govim in Avadim or Ein Govim in Avadim. He says, Amalei, Ein Govim Matnitin La, V'chein Amar Rabbi Nachman. So the way that the memra was bought from Rabbi Abba was incorrect. What Rabbi Abba said is, Ein govim in avadim. Not like what we have, which is govim in avadim. Rather, Rabbi Abba says, ein govim in avadim. And then it doesn't say Rav Nachman Amar, arguing on him, but Ella, v'chein Amar Rabbi Nachman. Rav Nachman supports that. So that's the one case where the halacha is not like Rabbi Abba, because Rabbi Abba didn't say it. What the Gemara is saying is that Rabbi Abba said the same thing that Rav Nachman said, which is, ein govim in avadim. And that's how we solve that stirup, to say that they actually agree now, and their agreement is Ein Govim and Avadim, which is different than what we saw in the original statement of Rabbi Abba. If that's the case, that in each of these instances we're saying the halacha is like Rabbi Abba, that implies that somebody argued on Rabbi Abba, and you're telling me the halacha is like him because we discard the other opinion. Well, now you just said to me in that first case, Rav Nachman didn't disagree. They agreed. So now saying the halacha is like Rabbi Abba is not as opposed to Rav Nachman, because Rav Nachman says the same thing. So then, when you say here the halacha is Rabbi Abba, who's that coming to oppose? Ilav who came into Rava. If it's coming to exclude Rava, Mosifu. Rava is not necessarily disagreeing with Rabbi Abba. He is only adding on to Rabbi Abba. So now, there are different ways to learn this. The way that the Rashbam learns it is that, who says that Rabbi Abba disagrees with Rava? Rabbi Abba said that a sheni b'shlishi is kasher. A first cousin once removed is kasher le'edut. Maybe the reason he said it in that case was because that was the case law that they were faced with. That was the situation that they're faced with. Who says that he doesn't agree that a shlishi b'rishon is also kosher le'edut? Maybe he would agree in that case as well. Just happened to be the case he was addressing is this particular case. When Rava comes along and says, v'chein shlishi b'rishon, it doesn't mean that Rabbi Abba disagreed with that. It just means that he wasn't addressing that case. And so Rava is considered to be a mosi. Rav is just saying, not only is it sheni b'shlishi, but also shlishi b'risha, but that doesn't mean that Rabbi Abba necessarily disagrees. So you won't have to say halacha to Rabbi Abba in that case, because who says that Rav is disagreeing that you have to give up psak or hachra between the two opinions? That's one way to learn it. The Bali and Tosafot bring a similar description, which is Efshar the Rabbi Avanami Moda the Rova can the perish for kuntres, like the Rashbam says. But then Rabbeinu Tam Pasuk the Sefer Yasher the Shlishi Berishon Pasul. He says that a third generation with the first generation is Pasul. V'chein Posek Halachot Gedolot, and so does the Bahag pass in this. El Sheim Einan Poslim Ela Midrabanan, but they only posel it Midrabanan. V'hu posel min haTorah. The Bahag only is posel it Midrabanan. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Tam says he's Pasul min haTorah. Umefarish Hochi. So now, how does the Rabbeinu Tam explain our Gemara? Our Gemara is saying there's no argument between Rabbi Ava and Rava, because Rava is a Mosi. That would imply that if the Loch is like Rabbi Ava, the Loch is also like Rava. So how can you say the Loch is not like Rava? So what the Bahav says is, that's Midrabanan. It's not, the Loch is not like him, so that's easy. Midor right, he's right. But nevertheless, the Rabbanan said, Shlishi Birishon is Pasul. Then the Rabbeinu Tam says, he's Pasul Midoraita. How does he deal with our Gemara over here? So he reinterprets the Gemara and says this. E at the mitzvah, the dafka shlishi b'sheni kasher, the lo shlishi b'rishon, in grab the meimar in alocha kirova. If the whole point of saying the locha is like Rabbi Ava is to come to exclude the position of rova, then the way you should have formulated it is in alocha kirova. The locha is not like rova, as we see the Gemara said before by Mar Bar Ravashi. Mar Bar Ravashi said that a grandfather can testify for a grandchild or vice versa. Over there, the Gemara said the locha is not like Mar Bar Ravashi. So what the Rabbeinu Tam is saying, the Gemara is saying that it can't be that the point of Mar Zutra's statement in the name of Shimi Barashi is to tell you the Locha is like Rabbi Abba to the exclusion of Rava. Because if that's what he was trying to do, there would be a much easier way to formulate it just to say, in Halacha Kerava. The fact that it says Halacha Ke Rabbi Abba, there's no reason to say it or formulate it in that way. It's just the exclusion of Rava. That doesn't mean that the Gemara believes Halacha is like Rava. Doesn't mean that Rabbi Abba necessarily agrees with Rava. All it's saying is that can't be the meaning of the statement of Halacha Ke Rabbi Abba. And therefore the Rabbeinu Tam says in the end, the Halacha is that we don't pasken like Rava. And the Halacha is that Shlishi Berishon is pasul midoraita. Though, the Ramban suggests that the Adam is so real that the Halacha was like Rava. And then clearly, Mar Zutra is not coming then to say that the Halacha is like Rabbi Ava, not like Rava, because that would undermine the Mesorah that the Halacha is like Rava. So that's why the Gemara over here says that can't be the reason he's coming, because Rabbi Mosifu, and obviously he doesn't disagree with Rabbi Ava, because we're saying the Halacha is like Rava. So now the Gemara says, well, if you're saying the Halacha is like Rabbi Ava to exclude Mar Bar Ravashi, who said a grandchild to a grandparent is kasher, there, late Nilchata Kamar Baravashi. The Gemara explicitly said, the Halacha is not like Mar Baravashi. You don't have to come and tell me now, later on, Halacha is not like Mar Baravashi. Ila Fuki Midishmuel, Rav Sheshiv Rav Papa. If you're going to say the Halacha is like Rabbi Abba by the blind person, that he may not testify if he went blind after witnessing the event, that comes to exclude the opinions of Shmuel, Rav Sheshiv Rav Papa, who said he can't testify in certain circumstances. Hayitotvu. We already asked from a Tanaic work that undermined their position. So you don't have to tell me the Halacha is like Rabbi Abba. It's obvious like Rabbi Abba because their positions were refuted by the Tanaic work. Ela, tafuke mid Rabbi Yochanan. It's coming to exclude the position of Rabbi Yochanan. The machloke between Rabbi Abba and Rabbi Yochanan. As whom we pass him like. Rabbi Abba said we pass him like Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yochanan said we pass him like the Rabbanon. So that statement now of Mar Zutra, Mishmei de Rav Shimi Barashi, that says Halacha ke Rabbi Abba, means Halacha is like Rabbi Abba, and not like Rabbi Yochanan. That means Halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda, and not like the Chachamim. Omeat kafta de Mar Baravashi. And it also comes to tell you that the question that Mar Baravashi poses in the case of Shvua is incorrect. When Rabbi Abba said that he has to take a Shvua, and not only does he have to take a Shvua according to Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, but he also has to take a Shvua even according to Rabbi Akiva. Mar Bar Ravashi came along and challenged that and says just the opposite. He shouldn't have to take a Shvua. And even according to Rabbi Shimon Elazar, he shouldn't have to take a Shvua. So when we come along and say the Halacha is like Rabbi Abba, that means the Halacha is like Rabbi Abba, and his formulation of that case, which the Halacha is, you have to take a Shvua even according to Rabbi Akiva. And we are not accepting Mar Bar Ravashi's logic that he shouldn't have to take a Shvua because he's a Meshiv Aveda, even according to Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. So that's what Mar Zutra, in the name of Shimon bar Ashi, was coming to do, was to come paskin like Rabbi Abba, to teach us all the other cases. We say the Halacha is like Rabbi Abba because nobody argues on him. In the first case, we changed his position to agree with Rav Nachman, so there's no disagreement, the Halacha is like him. In the next case of Yerusha, we already said that Mar Bar Ravashi's position was not halakhic, and Rova's position is kemosifu. He's simply just adding on to Rabbi Abba. He's not necessarily disagreeing. So according to the Rashbam, according to the way the Balei Tosfot themselves learn, that would mean that the halacha would be like Rava as well. Maybe he's disqualified to be the Rabbanan according to the Bahag, but the halacha would be like Rava as well. There's nobody disagreeing with him with regards to Yerusha. According to Rabbeinu Tam, you should have formulated it differently if you wanted to say that. Just say the halacha is not like Rava. Don't say the halacha is like Rabbi Abba. In the case of the blind person coming to testify, over there, the three dissenting opinions were removed, contradicted by a Braita. So of course the halacha is like Rabbi Abba. In the case of testimony of the father, over there we had a machloket, Rabbi Abba, who says the halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Yochanan, who says the halacha is like Rabbanan. Over there we paskin like Rabbi Abba, and the halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda against Rabbi Yochanan. And in this final case, where he's molded and mixed, and then the Edim come and disqualify the contract completely, in that instance, we pass him like Rabbi Abba, who says he has to take a shvuah for his motive and mixat, despite the fact that he looks like a Meshi Baved over here, because of the fear of the Edim. That's why he was motive and mixat, and not because he has a migo that he is considered to be a Meshi Baveda. And therefore, he has to take a shvuah, even according to Rabbi Kiva, not like the position of Mar Bar Ravashi, who says he doesn't have to take a shvuah here, even according to Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Kuf Chavtet, Amud Aleph.